Welcome, everyone. I'm Marilyn Stern, Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum, and I'll serve as Chair. It's our pleasure to welcome Mr. Max Boot as our speaker today. Mr. Boot is the Jean Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. A foreign policy analyst, author, and military historian, Mr. Boot has advised U.S. commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our topic today is the U.S. strategy to defeat ISIS. Last week, a Fox News poll reported that 64% of Americans surveyed said Obama has no ISIS strategy, expressing little confidence in the administration's efforts to confront ISIS. Also last week, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu warned that, I quote, to defeat ISIS and leave Iran as a threshold nuclear power is to win the battle and lose the war. Mr. Boot will offer his analysis regarding the dual threats posed by ISIS and Iran. Mr. Boot?
Great. Thanks very much. Happy to be here with all of you. And I guess I would begin by saying that I don't always agree with the American public as they express their views in polls. But in this case, I think the public view that, A, we need to do something about ISIS, and, B, that Obama has not offered a clear strategy to do so, I think that's a pretty accurate view of what's going on. And I think what happened essentially is that President Obama has been very determined, especially since 2010, to stay out of further involvement in Iraq and Syria. He refused the advice of most of his national security cabinet to do more to help the Free Syrian Army, and he refused to do more to try to keep U.S. forces in Iraq past 2011, both decisions that his former defense secretary and CIA director Leon Panetta has recently been criticizing him for. And, you know, it took an awful lot for him to reverse even partially his desire to disengage from the Middle East. And what it really took was in August, the horrifying headlines about Yazidis getting slaughtered in Iraq, and then the horrifying headlines about American journalists being beheaded in Syria. Now that together, I think, galvanized President Obama into doing something about the situation in Iraq and Syria, to wit, ordering the bombing first in Iraq and then in Syria of ISIS frontline positions. But the response has still been very gradual and limited. President Obama announced publicly that his goal was to degrade and eventually to defeat ISIS. Now, that gives you a clue as to his real intentions, because if you think back to World War II, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt did not say that their goal was to degrade and eventually to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese. They simply said their goal was to seek the unconditional surrender of our enemies, and it was presumed that degrading them was kind of a lesser included into the overall goal of defeating them. Well, the fact that President Obama feels compelled to spell out his goals in this manner, I think, suggests that his real goal is simply to degrade ISIS. And yes, he would like eventually to have them defeated, but his hope is that somebody else somehow will do this job in ways that will not require greater American involvement. I mean, obviously, I hope so too. We all hope so, but I am skeptical. What we've seen in the last few weeks is that despite the American bombing, ISIS has not been shaken in their control of territory larger than the territory of the United Kingdom, even including Scotland. In fact, in recent days, they've made disturbing gains towards the town of Kobani in northern Syria, a Kurd stronghold which is on the verge of falling to ISIS. ISIS fighters are also reputed to be in the streets of Abu Ghraib, which is a town only 15 miles from Baghdad International Airport. So these are very disturbing signs, and they are indicative of what one would expect, which is that dropping a few bombs, as we've done, are not going to shake this fanatical and determined group of terrorists and guerrillas who are trying to transform themselves into an actual state with an actual army in the middle of the Middle East. To achieve those goals, I think, will take a more ambitious commitment than President Obama has made to date. What will it take? Well, I think for starters, he needs to relax his ban on allowing U.S. troops to go into combat, not because we need to send large U.S. troop formations into combat, although he certainly should not take that off the table at the beginning, because if nothing else, that signals a lack of seriousness on our part. But at the very least, what he should be doing, I think, is allowing U.S. Special Operations Forces and regular forces to work alongside our allies on the ground as combat advisors, which will place them in some danger, but will vastly enhance the capabilities of the forces they're aligned with, allowing them to much more accurately call in airstrikes and to, in general, instill some discipline and leadership into forces whose combat effectiveness has not been very great of late. And specifically, I'm thinking here of the Kurdish Peshmerga, selected units of the Iraqi security forces, which have not been too heavily infiltrated by pro-Iranian militias, the Sunni tribes in Anbar province and in Syria, and then, of course, the Free Syrian Army. And there is a long way to go in all those cases, but we're going to need all those folks on the ground to make American air power the least bit effective. I think we would be making a great mistake if, instead of trying to galvanize those forces, instead we decided to work tacitly, as I think we may be doing now, with the Syrian regime and its Iranian sponsors. Now, that on a superficial level looks appealing, because you can always make that facile argument about the enemy of my enemy is my friend, except not so much in this case. I mean, if you actually look at it, there is considerable evidence of Syrian and Iranian complicity with al-Qaeda and ISIS. At the very least, Bashar Assad's regime has not been that interested in fighting ISIS, just as ISIS has not been that interested in fighting Assad's regime. Assad gains strength, he thinks, from allowing ISIS to run rampant, because then that makes the case to the world that the alternative in Syria is between Assad and ISIS. And ISIS, in turn, has little desire to pick a fight with Assad. They want to fight other groups for control of the Sunni rebel areas in Syria. So, you know, I think we should not automatically assume that the Iranians and their proxies are on our side. In fact, the Iranians and their proxies are really the greatest drivers of conflict here. They're really the greatest helpers, ultimately, of ISIS in both Iraq and Syria, because in both cases, the reason why ISIS has any support is because Sunnis in both Syria and Iraq feel so alienated from brutal sectarian Shiite regimes in Damascus and Baghdad, or at least Shiite dominated is how Sunnis perceive it. And that perception is fed by the bloodthirsty tactics employed by Assad's regime, working, you know, hand in glove with Hezbollah and the Iranian Quds Force, where they've been dropping barrel bombs and using poison gas, killing civilians indiscriminately. That drives Sunnis into allegiance with ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, which is almost as bad. The same dynamic is visible in the case of Iraq, where it was former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's sectarian agenda and the vicious behavior of the pro-Iranian Shiite militias, which has driven many Sunnis into embracing ISIS as the lesser alternative. So as long as the perception is rampant in Iraq and Syria that the United States is somehow aligned with Iraq and Assad and Shiite sectarians, we don't have a snowball's chance in hell of getting Sunnis to flip against ISIS, which is actually what's going to be the decisive moment in the campaign, just as it was in Anbar province in 2007 during the surge. It was when the Sunni tribes flipped that ISIS was finally on the road to defeat. Today, the Sunni tribes are not going to flip as long as it looks like they would have to fight with an alliance in which Iran and its proxies are prominent members. So, you know, I would strongly counsel against trying to reach any kind of understanding with the Iranian regime, although there's a lot of evidence that that, in fact, is what the Obama administration is contemplating, and that they view that they think that there is a possibility for a larger rapprochement with Iran that extends beyond the nuclear talks into trying to flip Iran into being an American partner rather than an American enemy in the Middle East. And if that's their goal, I think they're doomed to be disappointed, because there is no sign of softening that I see in the position of the Iranian regime, except for maybe tactical short-term reasons. But overall, Iran still rightly earns its title as the number one state sponsor of terrorism, and in one of the most anti-American regimes on the planet. So I don't think there's somebody with whom we can or should do business. Instead, I think in both Syria and Iraq, what we need to be doing is doing more to encourage the more moderate elements on the ground to present a serious threat on the ground to ISIS as well as to the Nusra Front. And I think potentially, rather than engaging with Iran and Syria, we should be doing more to engage with Turkey, despite the sometimes troubling behavior and rhetoric of President Erdogan. He has been, from the start, determined to oust Assad. And part of the reason why Turkey has not done more is because the Turks have not gotten the support they need from the U.S. or other NATO allies. And right now, I think Erdogan is still reluctant because to him and to people in Syria, what it looks like now is that the U.S. is simply bombing ISIS and we're not doing anything to hurt Assad. That means for many people in the region, we are tacitly assuming a pro-Assad stance, which I don't think is right, but that's how it's perceived. So I think we need to do more to show Erdogan and others, in the Sunni community in both Syria and Iraq, that we are serious about ousting Assad and fighting Assad just as we are fighting ISIS. I don't really understand why we're bombing ISIS, but we're allowing Assad's terror air force, which has inflicted so much death and destruction, why we allow that air force to continue flying. I think that's a big mistake. I think we should certainly take out his air force at a minimum to show that we are an equal opportunity belligerent in Syria, that we're willing to take on the gross human rights abusers of both the pro-government and the anti-government side. And, you know, if we were to do that, if we were to take a more active anti-Assad line, I think we might be able to get the Turks to do more, including possibly using their troops to set up enclaves in northern Syria where the Free Syrian Army and the opposition government could actually establish some of their authority in enclaves that could be free of both ISIS and government control. And so we could back a third way, a more moderate way in Iran, which will not be easy to do. But it's something that has to be done because otherwise the country and the region will continue to be torn apart by these vicious sectarians of both Sunni and Shiite extremes. But so far, to get back to the point that I started with, I don't really see Obama doing any of that. I see this as a very hesitant half step in the right direction, but I think we're still a long way from a cohesive strategy that actually gets from here to there, which is from, and by there, I mean the destruction of ISIS. We're an awfully long way from that in either Iraq and Syria, and I don't think it's going to happen unless we do more to step up our efforts. And right now what we're doing is I think, mainly symbolic, and it has some practical effect in making it harder for ISIS to continue rolling forward, maybe keeps them off balance a little bit, maybe keeps them focused less on external terrorist plots, but with, you know, all speculative. But the reality is, as I mentioned at the beginning, there is really no evidence that our bombing campaign has shaken their control of all this territory. And so it's going to take a bigger effort, and even then a time-intensive effort, to, I think, break the stranglehold that ISIS has taken on large parts of Syria and Iraq. So with that, I'd like to conclude my opening remarks and open it up to questions or comments.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Boot. And before opening the lines to our callers, I'd like to ask the first question. There are results of two further polls I'd like to get your read on. In one, 57% of Americans surveyed think that defeating ISIS will take boots on the ground. Yet in a separate poll taken among the U.S. military, 70% of them don't want to see boots on the ground in Iraq or Syria. How do you interpret these results?
With a grain of salt, I think the poll you're talking about, the U.S. military, as I recall, is not a scientific one. I think it was something run by Military Times based on readers writing in or something like that. You'd have to correct me because I don't have the methodology in front of me, but I don't think that's a scientific sample of the U.S. military. I mean, all the folks that I know in the military are scratching their head at Obama's hesitant strategy, and they're saying, basically, if we're going to do this, let's do this right. I mean, that's a message you've heard from retired generals like Jim Mattis and James Conway, and it's a message you're hearing in a veiled form from serving generals like General Marty Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Ray Odierno, Army Chief of Staff, General Lloyd Austin, head of CENTCOM. They're all saying that basically we're going to need combat advisors on the ground working with the various factions in order to be effective in our commitment. And Jim Mattis, who is one of the most respected generals of his generation, now retired, has spoken out very strongly about, you know, how he doesn't want to see any more Marines or soldiers dying in Iraq. He's written enough letters, condolence letters home already, but he also doesn't want to see ISIS continuing to exist indefinitely, and he believes that we need to step up our game if we're going to achieve our objectives. And, you know, I don't know what percentage of the U.S. military subscribes to that view, but I think it's anecdotally, I would say it's a pretty large share.
Good. Okay, thank you. And Kelly, can you please instruct our callers?
Absolutely. Thank you. The question and answer period will now begin, and we invite your participation. Please note that when there are no questions in the queue, the moderator will ask a question. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to identify yourself when your line has been unmuted, please do so. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we'll take our first question now. One moment. Caller, please go ahead.
Mr. Boot?
Yes.
Hello? Hi. Yes. Thank you. My name's David Edmund. Thank you for your comments. My question is, it does not appear that our president is learning from his experiences, from his mistakes, from what have you, and changing any of the preconceived notions with which he has come into office. So my fear is not much along the lines that you outlined that we should be doing in the next, or going to be possible in the next couple of years, unless there is some other kind of intervention. My question is, is it feasible, is it desirable to try to use Congress as a lever in getting the president to change his approach? Do you see any potential there, any value in a strategy along those lines?
Well, I think Congress has very limited leverage in this kind of situation where the president is invoking his commander-in-chief authority. You know, I suppose Congress could make some kind of symbolic step by passing a resolution calling, you know, for the U.S. to do more in the case of Iraq and Syria, but there's really no way to force a president to do more. I mean, there's, you know, Congress has the power of the purse. They can affect trade sanctions and so forth, and they did a good job of ratcheting up sanctions on Iran beyond what the Obama administration initially wanted. But in this case, you know, beyond kind of simply jawboning and, you know, driving the public discourse and putting some outside pressure on the president, there's not much that Congress can do. And you remember, it works both ways. I mean, in the case of the surge that President Bush ordered in December of 2006, Congress was adamantly opposed to that, the last thing that most people in Congress wanted to see. But again, they couldn't really stop Bush from doing it because they wanted him to be less active. And now Congress can't really force Obama to be more active.
Right.
It really has to be driven by what the president himself sees. And, you know, I'm not sure what it'll take for the president to kind of step up his game. It might unfortunately have to be another massacre along the line of the Yazidi massacre that he acted to avert. There could be another massacre about to occur of Kurds in Kobani, for example, that might cause him to rethink some of the limitations that he's placed on U.S. military action. By the way, there's one thing that Congress can do, which is not directly related to this, but I think would be important in a myriad of ways, which would be Congress needs to reverse the catastrophic cuts in our defense spending, which are now being enacted, which will cut $1 trillion of projected defense spending over the next decade, which will cut our armed forces by 30%. Those cuts are already causing readiness problems for all of our services, and if they are carried out to their full extent, they will make it almost impossible for the U.S. to defend all of its current commitments around the world. We need to do something about that, because even now, for example, as we're fighting on a very limited basis in Iraq and Syria, our armed forces are running low on Tomahawk missiles, which they're using to strike ISIS installations. I mean, it's crazy to me that when our forces are at war and they're being deployed for things like the Ebola emergency in West Africa or to deter Russian adventurism in Eastern Europe, all this is going on while we're trimming defense spending to the bone. That is an area where Congress can do something, and I would hope that that moderate Democrats and Republicans would step forward and understand that we can't afford these sequestration cuts while all these emergencies are going on.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take our next caller. One moment. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, caller.
Yes. On the question versus degrading versus defeating, well, I agree with you in principle. I'd rather defeat them. What does defeat look like? It seems to me we get it down to a certain level. Aren't they just going to blend back into the peaceful woodwork until we pull out again? How do you think that might play out?
That's a good question. And you actually put forward a term a little bit different from the one that President Obama used, because he talked about ultimately destroying them. You talked about defeating them. Destroying them, I mean, to the average civilian, those might sound like interchangeable terms, but, you know, to the military, those terms actually have different meanings. And destroy is a very high-order objective, very, very difficult to achieve because, you know, as you say, when you're fighting an insurgent group, I mean, how do you destroy them? They're liable just to, you know, put down their weapons temporarily, to go to ground, to stop fighting perhaps, but are they truly destroyed? But, you know, the level of defeating them is a slightly lower level objective, which I think is achievable, which, you know, can basically be defined as creating a situation where they are no longer a meaningful threat. And I think we essentially defeated the predecessor organization of ISIS, which was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I think they were essentially defeated in 2007, 2008, when violence in Iraq fell by more than 90%. They continued to exist in a very limited form, but they were no longer a major threat either to Iraq or to anybody else. Now, of course, we know what happened afterwards was that we left Iraq to its own devices. Prime Minister Maliki pursued a sectarian agenda, which then galvanized, and at the same time, the civil war started in Syria, which created an opening for these Sunni extremists, and, you know, the sectarian agenda in Iraq allowed them to come back into Iraq and to win support among the Sunnis. So even if we are able to defeat ISIS, there is no guarantee that they will not come back in the future, but what it will take will be wise, inclusive governance in Iraq and Syria, which is by no means guaranteed or perhaps not even likely, but, you know, that shouldn't stop us from acting decisively as we can against ISIS, because I do think we need to defeat them, and I think we should learn some lessons from the mistakes we made in 2010, 2011. We need to understand that even if we do defeat them, that doesn't mean we can just wash our hands of the entire region and go back home, because if we do that, there is a risk that the threat will rise up again. I think we need to have steady, low-level, long-term commitment to make sure that threats that are defeated stay defeated.
That's more or less what I was leading to, which is probably what upsets Obama. By the time we get there, hopefully he'll be irrelevant. But I guess this is putting too much of a crystal ball in front of you. But is it possible that we will stay there long term at some level? And I guess what I'm really saying is this what really upsets Obama and the Democrats?
Well, I think we will stay there long term at some level, even if the worst case is that we're going to do like what we did in 2010, 2011, which is to leave, and then the situation will get so bad that we're going to come back in. That's been the experience of the last few years. I mean, I would hope in the future that's one mistake we don't repeat again, and that we learn that, you know, if we have a steady state involvement, we can keep things, you know, once they get back on track, we can keep them on track. But the problem is once you leave and come back, as we're doing now, the mess is very, very hard to clean up. It would have been much easier to deal with this if we'd been much more proactive in 2010, 2011, as some of us had urged at the time. But because we've neglected Iraq and Syria in the meantime, oy vey, we've got, you know, a huge, huge mess on our hands, which is going to take years before we can get things, the situation back to the level it was at in 2010.
Exactly. One more very quick question. Are any of your books available in audio form?
That's a good question.
I'm not finding them.
Yeah, I don't think they are. They're certainly available in ebook form, as well as paperback and hardcover, but I don't think any of them has been issued as an audiobook.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. And that was the last caller in our queue.
Okay. I have a question for you that deals with the Kurds. Is there any possibility that the U.S. would declassify the Kurdish PKK and its Syrian Kurdish affiliate YPG as terrorist organizations in order to enlist their battle-tested fighters in the war against ISIS?
That's an interesting question. I would say the odds are not that high because we want Turkish support. And, you know, I'm not sure I would support delisting the PKK either because, I mean, they are they're Kurdish nationalists, but they're also Marxist. They're a pretty vicious terrorist group who have been responsible for a lot of death and destruction. So I'm not sure that we should do that, but, you know, tacitly on the ground, I mean, we don't, just because we list the PKK and their Syrian affiliate as terrorist organizations doesn't mean that we have to do very much to fight them, and I certainly would not recommend doing anything to fight them at the moment. Not that we've done that much to fight them either in the past. I think that we can still tacitly cooperate even with terrorists, but we have to be, you know, careful about doing so. But I think, you know, the big prize here is to get the Turks to do more, and something like that would be just like, you know, waving a red cape in front of Erdogan. So I don't think it's a smart strategic move.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, are there any more questions in the list?
Yes, we do have another caller. One moment.
Please go ahead.
Go ahead, caller.
Do you think there's any likelihood that after the November election that Obama will get more aggressive? In other words, right now he's, you know, afraid of losing his left-wing base. After that, nothing matters much. Could he suddenly turn more aggressive? Any rumblings to that effect?
I haven't heard any. I guess it's possible. One might also imagine that could happen if there is a more Republican cast to Congress after the November election, which you know seems likely. But, you know, I'm not sure that I think you would have to assume that what Obama is doing now is not what he believes in, but what he's doing for political advantage. I'm not sure that's true. I think he's actually doing what he actually believes in, which is as little as possible. And, you know, even after the November elections, you know, he's not going to face major electoral pressure one way, especially after the November elections, he's not going to face major political pressure one way or another because, you know, he's going to be leaving the presidency. He doesn't have to run for re-election. And so I think, you know, he's kind of liberated even more than now to do what he thinks is right. But that's actually what scares me because I think what Obama thinks is right is not what I would think is right. And I don't think it's as strong as a response as we need to the situation that we face. So I hope you're right that maybe he'll toughen up after the election. But I'm a little bit skeptical.
Actually, I agree with you completely, and that, not that I'm right. It's a hypothesis that was run up the flagpole by a Democratic friend of mine. I think you're right. I think the far left is so committed to its ideology, which means no boots in Iraq, that he doesn't care at all. So I think you're right on, frankly.
I mean, my theory, which I outlined in an article in the Weekly Standard recently, was that Obama was really liberated by the mission that killed bin Laden, because before that he was relatively moderate and centrist, and he acceded to people like Leon Panetta and Bob Gates and Hillary Clinton and others who were on the more moderate end of the administration. But then what I saw in his foreign policy was that he really turned in a more dovish direction after he killed bin Laden, because I think that kind of, in his mind, safeguarded him from any criticism from the right, because how can you accuse this guy of not being hawkish enough when he's the president who killed bin Laden? And after that is when he accelerated the drawdown from Afghanistan, didn't get involved in Syria, pulled out of Iraq, did all these other steps which he had not done earlier. And I think that's really a reflection of where his heart is, where his intellect is. That's really who he is. And I think he's really been acting not in a way designed to cater to public opinion, but really designed to do what he's right, which, as I said before, is I don't think that's the right thing to do, but that's what he thinks is the right thing to do.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've arrived at the end of our session, and on behalf of the Middle East Forum, I'd like to thank Mr. Boot for his analysis and comments, and to our callers for their participation. This concludes our conference call.